It's Friday, November 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, residents in Myanmar prepare to vote for president. Egypt and Russia seek the cause of a passenger jet crash in the Sinai.
They were trying to sell even the dead body. They never gave his body back.
VOA goes inside an Islamic State stronghold and finds graphic accounts of atrocities. Also ahead, we hear about some big winners in country music. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. As the people of Myanmar prepare to take part in historic national elections, opposition National League for Democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi told reporters on Thursday she has a plan to lead the country and thereby circumvent a constitutional roadblock if, as expected, her party wins.
I've not said we're going to win. I've said if we are win and the NLD forms a government, I will be above the president. It's a very simple message.
The 70-year-old Nobel laureate, who is barred from becoming president because her late husband was British and her two sons hold foreign passports, says she will run the government and we will have a president who will work in accordance with the policies of the NLD. Myanmar President Thein Sein has again pledged to hold free and fair elections Sunday, with the result reflecting the people's genuine desire. The general election will be the first since a nominally civilian government was installed in 2011, and this will be the first election the NLD will contest after the results of a 1990 ballot that the NLD won were annulled by the military. Nicholas Ferrelli, director of the Myanmar Research Center at the Australia National University, told VOA's Victor Beatty that this is a momentous occasion in the political life of a country that has known little of democracy. He says the true significance of the outcome won't be known until after the polls are closed, but in the weeks and months during a period of negotiation and compromise.
There's almost no comparison in the sense that the Myanmar of 1990 had just lurched out of a quarter century of socialist isolation. The Myanmar of 2015 is an increasingly cosmopolitan, globally connected society, which has, during this recent period of relative economic success, seen many millions of people vault out of poverty for the first time. The penetration of the internet and mobile phone technology is, of course, at an all-time high. The media is relatively free to report as it sees fit on sensitive political, social, and economic issues. But the country isn't anymore in a category all of its own. It has become one of Southeast Asia's semi-democracies. And as a result, I think we need to be somewhat careful about the comparisons that we draw with the events of 1990. Those events, of course, occurred in the immediate wake of the violence of 1988. There hasn't been that level of political consternation on the streets of Yangon or Myanmar's other big cities in recent times. And we all hope, of course, that through this electoral process, there'll be further opportunities for the Myanmar people to get to grips with just how much their country has changed.
Well, the country has no opinion polls, of course, but can anyone match the size and enthusiasm of the supporters of the National League for Democracy?
I very much doubt that anybody can match Aung San Suu Kyi's support base. Whether that translates into seats in the legislatures is a very different kind of question. Myanmar has a first-past-the-post voting system. That means that where there's relatively even competition, it's very hard to predict who it is might come up with the result. In many constituencies, there is at least a handful of different parties that are contesting, all of which are trying to put forward the most competitive possible candidates. Aung San Suu Kyi is trying to tell people that they should vote for her and vote for her party. We'll have to wait and see whether that's the kind of advice that the voters will follow.
Human Rights Watch has already issued a press release saying the election is fundamentally flawed. The process is undermined, it says, by systematic and structural problems, including the lack of an independent election commission, ruling party dominance of state media, a reservation of a quarter of the seats for the military, discriminatory voter registration laws, mass disenfranchisement of voters in some parts of the country.
Not a pretty picture, and I think Human Rights Watch is right to be pointing out the many flaws in the process that's underway right now. I'd suggest, though, that we need to maintain a certain level of optimism about what's going on. We are seeing a new level of electoral competition. There is simply no track record in Myanmar of doing anything like this. And the fact that the old military regime appears to be gradually surrendering a great deal of its power and authority suggests to me, at least, that good things might follow. Of course, it would be wonderful if Myanmar had the capacity to run an election of the sort that would pass muster with most advanced democracies around the world. That's unrealistic. A huge amount of effort has been put into trying to get some of these institutions up to a reasonable standard. I'd suggest, though, that we'll be waiting for at least another few iterations of this electoral practice before Myanmar has consolidated a system which is going to convince the sceptics and the critics that it is democratic to the level that some would like to see.
And while not ruling it out completely, Nicholas Fairley says that he does not believe the military will step in to halt this electoral process as it did 25 years ago. He says if Myanmar's democratic process fails at this stage, things could take a sharp turn for the worse. The Deputy U.S. National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, who recently visited Myanmar, also known as Burma, says a fair election result could have an impact on U.S. sanctions on a host of individuals and entities such as banks and companies. Well, while the election date is set for Sunday on our calendar, another momentous event just passed on our calendar, National Donut Day here in America. That means it's time for us to go to our social media segment and talk about one of my favorite things. What would that be? Donuts. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 to tell us more. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. Yes, Thursday was a National Donut Day here in America, but so was the first Friday of June. So understandably, that gets a lot of people confused.
I am already. What is the second National Donut Day this year? I mean, what are people saying about it on Twitter?
Well, first of all, American celebrity Vanessa Hudson sent out this tweet. Wasn't it just hashtag National Donut Day? That tweet seemed to resonate with a lot of people because it was shared about 400 times and more than 1,000 people liked it. Her handle is at Vanessa Hudson's. That's H-U-D-G-E-N-S. Another user named Danielle Sandler wrote, "Didn't we already have hashtag National Donut Day? What's up with all these quote-unquote days dedicated to getting type 2 diabetes? Almost 80 people liked that tweet.
Well, I'm sure not everyone is complaining for an excuse to have a treat. So, G, what are the two of the same days? Why are there two?
Well, good question. Online news aggregator Huffington Post tried to answer that. Its Twitter account at Huffington Post sent out this tweet and shared a link to an article. Hashtag National Donut Day is in June and November, but why? Based on the article, the summer holiday is a more legitimate one. The June National Donut Day was established by the Salvation Army back in 1938. That was to honor female volunteers who made donuts for soldiers serving overseas as a way to boost morale. The article reports that effort was successful and led to the American soldiers using the slogan, "Donuts will win the war."
Well, what about the Fall National Donut Day? What's that all about?
Well, sorry, that one is completely fabricated. It's made by a National Food Council as a way to sell more donuts. And judging by the mentions on Twitter, that trick seems to be working. Looking at the Topsia Analytics website, more than 26,000 people use the hashtag National Donut Day in the last 24 hours. Jim?
Well, maybe we can add a third to that and have National Donut Hole Day. Thanks for being here, G. She tweets for us on our VOA International Edition Twitter account. That would be at VOA underscore IE. You can also follow her on her own account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. British Prime Minister David Cameron says he believes it's more likely than not that a bomb brought down a Russian passenger jet over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula last week. But Egyptian and Russian officials dismissed his claim as speculative. Speaking before talks with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in London on Thursday, Cameron also noted that experts are not yet certain of the cause of the crash, which killed all 224 people on board. The Egyptian and Russian officials said that so far there is no evidence to conclude that a bomb was on the plane. Experts are examining the wreckage in the Sinai Desert for any signs of terrorism, while some reports say forensic examinations have revealed shrapnel in some of the victims. The Sinai affiliate of the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the disaster. Meanwhile, Egyptian officials are trying to rescue their tourism industry. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo that analysts say no matter what the cause of the crash, it's going to be a blow to Egypt's ailing economy.
Surrounded by mountains and desert and heavily guarded, Sharm el-Sheikh is usually considered a safe place in Egypt, in the past hosting international conventions, despite political upheaval in other parts of the country. Russian tourists are the largest single group visiting Sharm el-Sheikh, and Egyptian tour guides often speak Russian. Analysts say reduced tourist traffic after the plane crash is bound to be a blow for the Egyptian economy.
Tourism is going to be affected? Of course it's going to be affected, big time. So although there's been talk by some Egyptian tourism officials that a lot of Russian citizens have said that they will not give up the habit of coming to Hurghada and Sharm el-Sheikh for vacations, you really need statistics to kind of measure that. But the very simple rationale says that after such an incident, whether it's a technical error or it's an act of terrorism, the kind of how popular Egypt is as a target for tourism is going to be reduced. And this is something that we have to face.
Tourism is one of the most important sectors of the Egyptian economy, being a major source of foreign income and employment. The Egyptian government was planning to launch an international advertising campaign to promote Egyptian tourism just this week. In late September, Egyptian officials had predicted a large increase in tourism in 2016, from roughly $8 billion in income to as much as $10 billion. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Militants claiming to belong to the so-called Islamic State group have recently wrested control from the Taliban in certain areas of eastern Afghanistan. Locals say the brutality shown by this new bunch is unprecedented. VOA's Aisha Tanzim traveled into that area to talk to some of the victims.
He carries this passport-sized picture with him in memory of his dead son. Militants from the so-called Islamic State group killed the 15-year-old boy.
My son went to get wood from the mountain on his donkey to sell. He was very young, only 15. They fired three bullets in his chest. His name was Khalid.
Hundreds of others in eastern Afghanistan have been killed, beheaded, or sometimes blown up with explosives by the violent group. Victims include tribal elders, members of security forces, anyone who opposes the group, and sometimes just random civilians. This man is an eyewitness to some of that violence and was almost beheaded himself. He is still afraid to reveal his identity. IS accused him of being in border police. They took him away and made him wear an orange jumpsuit. As they got ready to behead him, locals intervened.
Locals, old people, old women intervened. They said to IS fighters, "He is a kid. Why are you beheading him?" They let me go. They killed the others who were there. Some they blew up, others they beheaded, and some they shot with guns. Allah saved me.
This video, uploaded by IS, shows the group blowing up 10 men, some of them old. All belonged to the local Shinwari tribe. Such violence has forced many to flee their homes.
This family is living in this tent because they had to leave their home and run away. They've experienced the violence of the so-called Islamic State firsthand. A member of their family was beheaded.
After the beheading, IS refused to return the body until the family paid for it.
They were trying to sell even the dead body. They never gave his body back.
Then IS found another way to get the family's money. They captured the dead man's father and threatened to behead him as well. The family paid up and fled the area. The group's brutality is worse than anything people in these areas have experienced before. Compared to them, locals say, Taliban seem almost tame. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan.
See inside the Islamic State stronghold with Aisha Tanzeem. The video is on our website at voanews.com, or you may watch it if you have a smartphone. All you have to do is download the free VOA app. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The Country Music Awards were just held. Do you know who the big winners were? Well, VOA's Susan Yockey and Nikki Strong do, and they're in the studio to talk about them.
One of the biggest events in country music happened last night, the Country Music Association Awards, the CMAs. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to fill us all in. Welcome, Nikki.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, good, thank you. Hey, first, who won what?
Okay, all right, so Female Vocalist of the Year, Miranda Lambert. Male Vocalist of the Year, Chris Stapleton. Vocal Group of the Year, Little Big Town, well-deserved, Girl Crush. Their song actually won for Song of the Year. Vocal Duo of the Year, Florida Georgia Line. New Artist of the Year was Chris Stapleton. And Entertainer of the Year was Luke Bryan.
Do any of these surprise you?
Okay, so this is what excited me.
Uh-huh.
And that is, and this ties into Justin Timberlake coming on the show. Chris Stapleton was like the underdog that cleaned up. So he was able to take away three awards for Male Vocalist of the Year, Album of the Year, New Artist of the Year. Now, even though he's a well-respected songwriter and singer, he's written for Adele. He's written for a lot of big names in country music. And people love his work. However, his solo project, this is his first solo debut, came out in May and has not had the commercial push and the awareness that his other nominees have had. So in these award ceremonies, sometimes you're like, okay, is it gonna the most popular going to win, or is it the one with best quality? And so his album Traveler was well respected and well received. So the fact that he wound up picking up three of the awards encouraged and inspired everybody, all country music lovers, the artists and the nominees alike, so much so that when Luke Bryan got up to accept his award as Entertainer of the Year, he even expressed his excitement about how well Chris has done that evening. So that, I think, was the biggest surprise, in addition, of course, to Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Justin Timberlake.
I heard he blew people out of the water with his duet.
Oh, my goodness. So, and the thing is, Justin Timberlake is doing the duet with Chris Stapleton on the stage, and they're doing the cut Tennessee Whiskey. It's like a bluesy, I don't want to say jazzy, it's more of like a blues cut,
mm-hmm.
On the country music spectrum. And tears it up. It was amazing. So no one was expecting it. And then for it to be with Chris Stapleton and for it to be that cut and for it to be as phenomenal as it was, that just added to the excitement and the inspiration. And by the way, Justin Timberlake has showed up and has been a part of a couple of high-profile country music events. And, you know, he's a Tennessee native. So there is buzz that he might be working on a country album without really letting us know.
Well, he can really do anything, any kind of form of music.
He can. Why are these CMAs so important? Okay, so the CMAs, so their objectives are pretty much to guide and enhance the development of country music throughout the world and to demonstrate it as a viable medium to advertisers and consumers and media. And basically, they see themselves also as an agent for unity within the country music industry, and their award show really encapsulates all of that. And so the actors have their Emmys, the country music artist have the CMAs.
Yeah, it really brings attention to country music, and most people might not be exposed
to it. Exactly. And this is a great way, especially with Justin. That's a great tie-in. And there's been a lot of crossover country pop artists. But this is really the night where country artists get to shine on their own.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com, and we're on Twitter any time of the day or night. You can follow us on your computer or your smartphone, our handle at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, and I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We all thank you for joining us. We hope you have a great weekend. Come back and see us next week. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
International efforts to stop the carnage in Syria are intensifying. Last week, 19 nations, including the U.S., Russia, Iran, and a number of Arab and European countries, as well as representatives from the European Union and the United Nations, convened in Vienna for bilateral and multilateral talks to explore the framework for a political solution to the violence that has been raging in Syria. The violence began when Syrian President Bashar al-Assad turned tanks and bullets on peaceful, pro-democracy protesters in March 2011. The conflict has since spiraled into civil war and given rise to the growth of terrorist groups like ISIL. After the meetings, Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized it will take pressure from many different directions to reverse the escalation of conflict and to lay a credible groundwork for peace. He reiterated the U.S. position that ISIL and other terrorist organizations can never be allowed to unite or govern Syria, adding that there is no way Assad can unite and govern Syria either. Syrians deserve a different choice, said Mr. Kerry. Secretary Kerry asserted, however, that the parties can't allow their differences on Assad to get in the way of the possibility of diplomacy to end the killing and find a solution. At the conclusion of the meetings, the participants issued a joint statement laying out agreed-upon principles going forward, including a commitment to Syria's unity, independence, and territorial integrity, to the protection of the rights of all Syrians, to the defeat of ISIL and other terrorist groups, to the need to accelerate all diplomatic efforts to end the war, and to a UN-led effort to convene meetings between the Syrian government and Syrian opposition, with the goal of credible, inclusive, non-sectarian governance in Syria, followed by a new constitution and elections. Another agreed-upon principle was a commitment that the political process will be Syrian-led and Syrian-owned, and that the Syrian people will decide the future of Syria. The participants agreed to meet again within the next 2 weeks. Secretary of State John Kerry said the challenge for the international community is to help chart a course out of hell. It won't happen overnight, but if the steps taken in Vienna are worked on in good faith, Mr. Kerry said they can begin to move us in the right direction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.